Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Today's guest is Chris Johnson. His pronouns are he and him. And I'm just going to read you a bit about his bio. So Chris Johnson is a New York-based photographer and filmmaker. He received his undergraduate degree in film production, along with a minor in religious studies, from Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec. His photography has been seen in various outlets, including the New York Times. He is the author of the coffee table photography book, A Better Life, 100 Atheists Speak Out on Joy and Meaning in a Wonderful World Without God. You can see it in the camera with Eric, as well as the documentary film version, A Better Life, An Exploration of Joy and Meaning in a World Without God. He has traveled the world on a screening lecture tour, A Better Life, speaking and screening the film in over 120 cities in four continents, from Reykjavik to Shanghai. And in addition, he is the co-producer, co-director, and co-writer of the recent documentary film Merrily Marvelous, The Dancing Genius of Wim Burton, which premiered on the BBC in 2019. So, Chris, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. I'm super excited to have you. And yeah, it's just great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and be here with all these wonderful people I'm seeing on the screen right now.
And you know, what we can do now is add the award-winning documentary, Merrily Marvelous, can't we?
Oh, that's right. We won an award at a film festival yesterday. It's very exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, welcome. And many people here know who you are, but I would suspect most of them don't. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I always suspect that people don't know who I am, so I'm always excited if they do. But yeah, so just a little bit about me to start out with. I grew up in Seattle, which is where I am right now, actually, because of the whole COVID stuff. I'm in Seattle. I grew up here in the 80s, you know, Seattle in the 80s, very liberal place to grow up. My parents raised me and my brother, I have one brother, in a very non-religious way. I mean, my dad's a liberal Christian, very liberal, but raised us really without any religion. I remember, I think when I was about 4 or 5 years old, I got a children's Bible from, I guess, some family member. I don't even remember who it was from, but I got one for Christmas. And I remember asking my dad where the dinosaurs fit into the whole narrative, right? So even at that age, I was skeptical of religion. But I didn't really know a whole lot about it or really think that much of it. My mom is not religious at all. My parents divorced when I was 11 or 12. And so I just kind of just went through life here in Seattle, graduated high school, moved to Montreal where I went to university. I went to Concordia University, film production major. And while I was there, just out of pure interest, I took some religion courses. And you know, just because I found them interesting. And the first religion course I took actually was a course on religion and sex. And it was fascinating. I had no idea kind of the history of religion and sex and kind of how different religions look at sex and kind of sexual representation within religions and all this stuff. And it was just fascinating. So I just took more courses on religion. And I ended up minoring in religious studies because I'd just taken all these courses because of how interesting it was to me. And also around this time, it was, you know, 2004, 2005. I graduated in 2005. And that was also around the time the whole new atheist movement really kind of came into fruition, right? And so it really got me thinking, like, okay, well, I wasn't really religious, but, you know, where do I fit into this whole kind of religion question? Mm-hmm. Here's this whole atheism thing that's really kind of starting right now. And so I kind of, I read The God Delusion when it came out and Sam Harris's The End of Faith. And and really kind of jumped on the whole atheism thing, because the timing just worked out right at that moment. So, that's kind of where I started from there. I then moved to New York and started working various jobs. When I moved to New York, did kind of the struggling artist thing. And I had a job actually as a tour guide at Madison Square Garden for 2.5 years. I worked there.
Madison Square Garden needs a tour guide?
A number of them. Yeah.
I always just see it as this gigantic like arena or stadium, but is it more than just that? Like, did you just walk people in like, all right, here it is over there's the stages usually. And here's some seats. This one you have to pay extra for. Is there more than just that at Madison Square Garden?
There was. Yeah. Yeah. So there was like, they had like club restaurants that you could visit, and they had locker rooms you could visit, and they had,
The
luxury boxes you could visit. So you go on a tour, especially if there wasn't like an event going on, people could still go and like tour the arena and see like behind the scenes stuff. And it was really, it was kind of fun. It was interesting. I mean, I got paid to just kind of talk for a living, which is kind of what I do now. Right. but that was fun. And actually I was just thinking about it the other day, Holly Leisig, who is in the band Lucius, which is pretty popular band right now. She was one of my coworkers there. So there were a bunch of us who were kind of figuring ourselves out and trying, you know, doing the whole struggling artist thing while having this day job as well. It was interesting, but we all got laid off. They were going to do some renovations in the arena, and they laid us all off. And so we were just kind of like, oh, what are we going to do now? And then I just kind of got into doing photo and video kind of freelancing in New York, doing like red carpet photography, that kind of thing, news photography stuff. And
paparazzi.
And I did that. I mean, not like chasing people down, but like, yeah, like stuff that, you know, was in magazines and newspapers and things like that.
Yeah.
It was okay, but I wasn't feeling great about it. I wasn't kind of doing something that I felt fulfilled and excited about doing, right? And it was also a bit of a struggle too. It wasn't like, it wasn't really, that secure of a job either. So in 2011, in the summer of 2011, I took a road trip with my brother. We traveled across the United States, actually kind of did a big triangle. We started in San Antonio, where he was living at the time, drove up to Seattle, and then across up to British Columbia, across Canada, down to New York, and then down the East Coast to Florida, and then across back to Texas again.
Wow.
So we did that, and it was amazing. And on this road trip, we listened to a lot of atheist podcasts driving along, and we stopped at a lot of national parks on the way, and we stopped at White Sands National Monument in New Mexico, which I hadn't been to before, and I was just like blown away. It was the most incredible place I'd ever been, because it was just these incredible sand dunes. And that's all you'd see, just surrounded by these sand dunes that were just pure white. It was like snow, but it was sand, right? And you just see these dunes going on, stretching off into the distance, and then mountains. And it was incredible. And so kind of the combination of being in these beautiful places and thinking about kind of ideas of God and atheism and all that, it was really interesting. And my brother said to me, you know what you should do, Chris? You should make a photography book, because I was taking a lot of pictures too. And I said, oh, that's not a great idea. I mean, how many photography books are there out there? I mean, nobody cares about me. Nobody cares about my work. And he said, well, you just have to think of a way of making something different. And so all these ideas kind of came together, like, oh, okay, well, atheism, religion, photography book. Like, what if I made a photography book about atheism? What if I made a book about atheism that wasn't just, this is why religion is bad, or this is why religion is harmful, which is an important book to have, for sure. But what if it was something where it was, here are a bunch of smiling, happy atheists. Here's atheists talking about how they can live a life without God that has meaning and purpose. Here are these people who are having these conversations, and you can kind of peer into their lives through these photographs, of representing their life through pictures. And I thought, wow, this is a really great idea. And I thought for sure someone had already done it. you know, you always have an idea and you always think, oh, this is a great idea. And then you look and someone's already done it. And I remember actually that when I got home, I checked and I was trying to find like, who's already done this? And I couldn't find it. So I was like really excited to do it at that point.
I think it was very relevant that you did a positive outlook on atheist lives, because I feel like a lot of religious communities portray being an atheist as the most miserable thing you can be, and that you have no purpose in life. You are going to be sad. You're going to be depressed. You're going to be falling into nihilism. You know, there's no God, there's no meaning, no anything. And I feel like it was something that I think was very needed to maybe a few religious people, or not, I mean, ex-religious people who are still like in the closet of belief, who are trying to come out, but were scared of being depressed and getting, you know, mental health issues and not finding purpose in life. So I think that was a really great initiative.
I think also showing the community and the diversity of atheists, because I think a lot of people just think of atheism as kind of the old white college professor sitting in the ivory tower, right? People associate that with atheism. And so kind of showing a diverse and rich community of people, I think, was really important as well. And that was one of the kind of missions that I had in doing this.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other points that you wanted to make in writing this book? Like, how would you define his purpose?
I think a lot of it was kind of showing, like I said, showing the diversity of people, showing the diversity of thought, putting a positive face on atheism. Because I think a lot of what we do, and rightly so, is pushing back against religion that we see as harmful, right? And I think there's definitely a lot of, a lot of validity to that. I think that's an important role, but I think a lot of what we were missing was kind of the flip side of that. Like, okay, you take all that away and what are we left with? What do we have to hold up as our own? How do we see the world, right? That's not just, this is what we are against. And I think there's, you know, for me, a lot of what came out of that was this idea of freedom and responsibility, right? Like, so we have this immense amount of freedom to kind of create our own lives, right? To decide what's important to us. It's not dictated from on high. But also there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. You know, it's up to us then, right? Like there's freedom that, oh, it's up to us, which is great, but also, oh, it's up to us because it's all on me now, right? But it's again all on us because we have this rich community of people that we can draw from with ideas and resources and support, you know, which is exactly what this organization does, which I love.
That's fantastic. We had a talk with Danielle Lasusa, who is a philosopher, who talked a bit about what you just said, you know, having to bear the weight of creating your own meaning and how challenging that can be for not just someone who is ex-religious, just for any person that has ever lived. Like that is just like a general theme, I don't know, like a narrative in so many different people, in so many different cultures. So it's definitely a super important conversation to have. And I feel like a photography book is a really creative way of portraying that. So, I mean, I haven't bought your book yet, but I'll definitely do it. And I'm super excited to read it and to enjoy it, obviously. So can you tell us a bit about how was the creation of the book? Like, where did you start from? Because one thing is to have the idea and then something else is to actually put it into place and actually work on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an ordeal going from just the idea to kind of the finished product, right? So the first thing was the money, right? It was going to cost a lot of money to put something like this together, especially a big coffee table photography book. So I didn't really know how to do that. I spent about kind of 6 months like just kind of formulating the ideas and thinking about how to do this. And I found Kickstarter. So I ended up doing a Kickstarter to raise the money to do it. And that was the most stressful 2 months of my life. Going through that process. But it was rewarding, and actually it ended up succeeding, and it was the second highest grossing publishing project that Kickstarter had done at that time, which I thought all for a book about atheism was pretty cool. So I raised the money to do it from the community, which again kind of supports this idea of community, right? Community came together to do it. And it took about, I think, a year and a half of traveling and, you know, interviewing people and just going through the whole process of putting the book together. It was a long, long process putting it together. But I got to meet all these amazing people, people from different walks of life, people from different backgrounds, you know, people who kind of fit the model of what we think of as atheists, like Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett, people like that, but also people that, you know, you don't think about when you think of atheism. Alex Honnold, the rock climber, who was featured in Free Solo. I met with him, and you know, Adam Pascal, who's a Broadway singer and actor. You know, all these different people from different walks of life, different religious backgrounds too. I got to meet and have conversations about kind of how they see the world, and kind of try to capture a piece of them for the project.
Can you give us a bit, like a couple of examples of the people you interviewed? Because I feel like one of the parts of RFR is obviously to share these stories of atheists or ex-religious people, so that can have a massive, like, positive impact on other, either religious in the closet or already out of the closet, but still trying to figure it out. So can you share, I don't know, a couple of anecdotes or stories of the people who you interviewed?
Yeah, again, kind of the diversity was really important to me. Kind of, I wanted people from kind of different backgrounds, different walks of life as well. So, you know, Eric mentioned Nick Robertson before, who's a friend of mine in New York, who's an airline pilot, and he's in the book. And we took pictures of him on, you know, not flying, but in his airplane, right? You know, just talking about his kind of growing up in the South, growing up in a very religious environment, and kind of always wanting to follow his dream of being an airline pilot, and kind of going towards that, and kind of and dealing with this kind of oppressive religious environment around him at the same time. I mean, I met so many people, you know, people who had wildly different experiences. I mean, one of the things I kind of learned a lot in this project is really kind of how privileged I was to grow up without religion. And it's something I've actually thanked my parents subsequently for, because I met so many people who struggled and had to go through so much to kind of undo the damage that they saw was caused by kind of religious indoctrination growing up. And for me, I had none of that. There was no moment where I had to think, oh, I don't believe in God. Like, this is a real struggle for me. And so for me, kind of recognizing that privilege in myself that I didn't have to go through that, was hoping that people could read these stories and look at these other people's examples of this is what they went through, which might kind of help people move along in their own journeys. Mm-hmm. That's how I see them.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. Like, one of the things that I have learned in RFR is just how privileged I am, because I was born in a family without any religion. Like, they were always very agnostic about it. I heard the word God for the first time when I was like 7 or something, like, you know, later right. in life. And I just didn't understand the concept of a God or anything. So, and then coming to RFR and listening to all of these, you know, stories about people who were born into this incredibly, like, close-minded, fundamentalist religions. It was just like so eye-opening. So I imagine it must have been fairly similar to you, even if you were born in a religious family, but not in that kind of culty spirit that other religions have.
Right. And it's you know, and I use the word privilege intentionally there, because it's one of those things that is invisible when you're in it, right? It just looks normal to me, right? And so you just don't see it. I mean, it reminds me a lot of, I had this really fascinating conversation with a group of family members, cousins of mine, and the women were talking about all their experiences with catcalling and being, you know, sexually harassed, right? And all the men had no idea this was a thing. They had never experienced it because they don't experience it, right? And so, I mean, they were just shocked that this happened all the time. And it's one of those things, it reminds me of that, where it's like, when you don't experience it, you just don't think about it. And so, you know, for me, in creating this project and working on the book and working on the film, just trying to highlight these stories to show, look, this is a rich and diverse group of people out there who have, many of whom have gone through certain experiences to get where they are. And maybe those stories can help people today going through certain things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so important, because atheism is not innocent of, you know, whitewashing and of not portraying any females or anything like that. Like if you look at the biggest atheist names, the majority of are white cis men. Like it's just like, so I feel like it's easy to feel like you are not part of that community because you don't see yourself represented in it. So I feel like that was, again, very important part of the work and something that probably inspired many, many people to buy your book because it was a conversation that wasn't existing in that time. I mean, right now it's not really existing that much either. So I can imagine that back then it was even worse. I mean, when did you publish the book? How many years ago?
4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, like that's a fairly long time in terms of social justice issues. So.
Yeah, I know. Things are a bit different now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's another issue of kind of role models too. Like they're, you know, everybody I would hope can look at the book and look at people in the book and find people that they can look at in kind of a role model fashion, right? Like look at people who remind them of themselves and kind of use that as a guide towards bettering their own life.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many people did you include in the book?
100.
100 people. Oh, because that's the subtitle, 100 Atheists.
Yes. easy number.
Amaya is asking all these great questions, and I ask a really dumb one. It's just fantastic.
Parfait. I'm going to confess, I didn't process. It was literally 100 atheists, so you're not the only one, Eric.
I should point out that I didn't realize how many 100 was until I started doing this. I'm like, oh, like 100 is a lot of people.
So. Yeah, looking through the table of contests is just dense with fantastic names and people. So it looked like, reading through the book, it looks like there's two different types of styles here. It seems like folks wrote into you, and also it seems like there was interviews that were conducted. Is that right?
Yes. So it's a combination of some were kind of transcribed interviews and some were kind of essays that were written before the book.
What were some of the main questions that you asked for folks to kind of help them, to prompt them to do this interview or for the writing? And
basically, I wanted it to be very open-ended. I didn't want to just conduct the same interview 100 times, right? So I wanted to kind of tailor my conversations with each person kind of specifically to kind of their life history, their lifestyle. You know, Alex Honnold, for example, you know, we talk a lot about kind of how he sees death and that kind of thing, but also like his religious upbringing and stuff like that too. But, you know, I didn't want to just be the same interview for every person, but I did want to kind of talk about similar themes and ideas, you know, talk about these ideas of joy and meaning and purpose in our lives without God. Because I think a lot of people, as we saw in the polls before our chat, a lot of people did and do struggle with those questions.
So not only did you write this book, like it is a heavy book. Is it an insult to call it a coffee table book, even though it's like super educational at all?
I call it a coffee table book just because it's heavy and big. And
yeah, the paper is fantastic. And the pictures are just, you took all the pictures. Is that right? Am I to understand?
I did.
That?
Yeah.
And they're just so well, this looks incredibly professional. This is the first book that you've ever written, right?
it is. Yeah. Yeah. And also my brother was the one who said you should do a photography book. He's a graphic designer. And so he did the layout and he had never done a book before. And so when he first sent me his like sample prototype when we were, you know, figuring out what it was going to look like, putting the layout on the pages, I was really worried because I thought, oh no, what am I going to say if it's really bad? And, you know, but literally every sample that he sent ended up being in the book.
That's
like
cool.
I couldn't say anything wrong about it. They were just fantastic. So he did a really good job at that too.
Now, you didn't go to school to write a book didn't major in English literature. How were you able to use your film education with this book at all?
Yeah, I mean, filmmaking is a lot about collaborating. Filmmaking is a lot about working under pressure and stuff like that. So it's, I think the skills you learn in film school, I think, translate very well to other places. So I worked with a lot of people who helped in doing editing and going through and proofreading and combing through to find mistakes and things like that. Like it's a lot of work. So it wasn't just me doing it. Everything is collaborative, I've discovered.
That was kind of a question to lead you in to talk about the documentary that accompanies this book.
Oh, sorry. I didn't pick up on that.
It's okay.
It's the lockdown. I'm just...
Let me rephrase that. So not only do you have this incredible book, but you also have a documentary that you made that accompanies the
book
called A Better Life.
And look, I have a DVD of it right here.
What?
Yeah. DVD? I know. What's a DVD? I have no idea. Yeah, so all the interviews I did for the book, I filmed, right? So then when I was done with the book, not only did I have all the stuff for the book, but I had all this footage, right? So on to my next project, which was putting together the film version, which was kind of a medium I was actually more comfortable with. So I spent about 9 months working on that, putting that together, doing additional reshoots and things like that. And I did... And I put that together and I did a screening in London. I premiered it in London at Conway Hall. And I did a little Q&A afterwards and it was great and we had a good time. And I thought, okay, I'll do a couple more of these like screening, lecture, Q&A events. And they just kept going and going and going. And as you said in the intro, I did over 125 of them on 6 continents. I forgot to add the additional 2, but it ended up being 6 continents total in 17 countries, I think.
Wow. Well, we need to somehow get you to screen it on at McMurdo Station in Antarctica, and then you can kind of round out the continents.
I know. I really want to do that. It's actually something I want to do at some point in my life. But yeah. So but it was rewarding just going out and seeing, not just doing something that's kind of theoretical and making a film, but going out and seeing people experience the film at the same time is really rewarding as well.
Did you just screen it in theaters or halls like the Conway Hall, or what was that experience like?
All kinds of different places. That was one of the cool things about it, was that every screening was different. I did screenings in people's living rooms. I did screenings in people's backyards. I did screenings in giant movie theaters giant theaters that seat 1500 people. I did 2 screenings in planetariums. I did a screening in the southernmost planetarium in the world. All kinds of, that was one thing that was cool about it, was every event was different.
How did people, so people just kind of reached out to you and say, hey, we would love for you to do a screening here. Can you come and, is that kind of how it worked?
Sometimes it was a combination of that, but also me reaching out to organizations and groups. Yeah. So I tried to organize things in terms of like tours as much as possible, because that cuts down on the cost.
Sure.
If you're doing a lot of kind of round trips to various places, it takes more time and it also is more expensive. So I really wanted to cut down on the cost of it. So I would try to do like a Midwest tour all kind of in one go. I remember I did once where I did like 6 screenings in 6 days, where I would do, I think that was the Midwest, where I just do kind of a screening, spend the night, fly somewhere else, do a screening, fly somewhere else, do a screening. And I would just go kind of 6 in a row there.
Didn't you end up sick of watching the same thing like over and over again after working so long?
Well, that's the other thing that was fun about it, is that I would never watch it. I would always set a timer on my phone and then go do something else while the movie was playing, while everybody else watched it. And so I would do like various things. Like one time I went to go get a haircut. one time, like I would do other work, just sitting, sitting in hallways, working on my laptop or whatever. Just various other, you have dinner, like various things while people are watching the movie. I didn't want to watch it all the time because then I would just get tired of it.
What was the reaction from folks that you got?
It was really great. It was really great. It varied. Some people were, crying at the end of it. Some people were, thinking about things they hadn't thought about before. It was great. People to again, like most of the times, if you make a movie and you just kind of put it out in the world, all you see are kind of movies online, or you occasionally see what people think. But actually, like being there in the room right after they've seen the movie, and kind of getting that initial feedback, and seeing how it affects people is really cool. I mean, it's the same with the book too, in a way, because like, you know, the books are all in my dad's basement, right? So whenever one gets shipped out, like I ship it out, right? Like I print out a shipping label. And so I see where the books go. And so, you know, books have gone to Saudi Arabia. Books have gone to Sudan. Books have gone to Japan.
They've been to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know if it got through. It didn't get returned. So it presumably went through. I got an order from someone who was a chaplain at a federal penitentiary. So, I mean, that's just one of the cool things about creating something like this too, where you just, you don't know where it is going to go. And then you see little glimpses of where it's ended up. And it's very rewarding to see that.
Did you have anyone in either the screenings or like your book tour that was like outraged, you know, like a very religious person who was like, I can't believe this is a thing, and reacted badly? Or was everything like fairly decent and peaceful, let's say?
It was generally pretty peaceful. I did get religious people who came to the screenings, and from what I remember, everybody was very nice about it. I had a when I did a screening in Peru, one of the most popular kind of evangelical preachers showed up and was there and was very kind and just said, you know, thank you very much at the end and left. And I did a screening in Phoenix, and a guy stood up during the Q&A and said, hey, I just want to let you know that I'm Christian. I'm actually a pastor here in Phoenix. And thank you for showing this other side of atheism, because until today I had no idea.
Wow.
You know, I thought of atheists in this other negative way. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's actually gotten a lot of really nice feedback from religious people.
Are you still doing the screening tours, Chris, 4 years after the book has come out?
No, which I'm very glad at actually now, because of the whole COVID situation. If this had happened when I was doing that and traveling so much, it would have been a lot worse. But no, I've really, you know, I did a lot of them, and then I just had to kind of move on to do other work. As you mentioned, I worked on the Gwen Verdon film, which just came out. I had to kind of stop it, but I still did some other lectures and some screenings around whenever I was asked to do them. Like I saw Daryl last year in Wisconsin. We were there together, and so yeah, various things, but not the extent of what I was doing before.
Yeah.
So following through what you mentioned before about telling the stories, positive stories of atheist individuals, do you have any tips other fellow atheists, agnostics, or ex-religious people so they can implement a bit more of that positivity in their lives?
Yes, I actually wrote some down here, some notes. And this is, I went back and listened to a podcast I did with my friend John Hall, who's in the book, actually. And he's a psychiatrist in North Carolina. And he's just such a great guy. And this is something we talked about when I interviewed him for the book and also for the podcast I did with him, to kind of talk about, as somebody who knows a lot about kind of the human mind and how we work as people, I wanted to kind of pick his brain about these things. So this is what he said when I asked him about kind of how we can think about our lives in a different way. How can we better our lives in this world without God, right? And the first thing he said was go back to basics, right? So get enough sleep, exercise, and create a good balance of work and personal life. You know, we get very obsessed with kind of job success and all that, and there can be an imbalance in many cases between kind of job and personal life. So trying to find a good balance between those, I think, is really important. And I love that he said that. He also said, accept that change is going to be a part of life and expectations are not always going to be fulfilled. You know, we often think that, you know, life shouldn't be a particular way, right? We often think that we often fight against change in our lives. I mean, I do that. And it's, I think, one thing that I found useful is kind of taking what he said to heart, is kind of accepting that things are going to change. And kind of just going with it in a certain sense. And that most of our suffering comes from our own expectations, you mentioned as well, which is very Buddhist, right? And that's something I found as well in my own life, taking into account what he told me. Because I think for me, a lot of why I was upset about something has to do with the expectations I had going into it. And if I kind of can let go of that, even if it's for a brief moment, I find a bit of peace, a bit of calm in that. And learning which things are in your control and which things are out of your control. And I think part of this comes back to what I talked about before about kind of the responsibility and freedom aspect of there not being a God, right? Like, there is a lot of freedom in that, right? There's not some kind of overseeing person looking down on us and moving the chess pieces around. And it gives us a lot of freedom, but also it gives us a lot of responsibility in figuring out what things we have the freedom to change, what things I can do to achieve the goals that I want to achieve, I think is very important. And also realizing that life is collaborative, as I mentioned before. Like, that's one thing that I've talked about before, is that kind of nobody does it on their own. I mean, people have said to me, oh, Chris, you know, you did this book all by yourself. And it's like, no, I didn't do it all by myself. I can't do anything by myself, right? Like, I rely on all these other people who help, you know, financially back it, who help buy the book, who help me work on the project, who help let me tell their stories. I mean, all these people, it's nobody does anything on their own, truly. Everybody, you know, works with other people. We all work with everybody else. And I think if you think about that kind of more of as a collaborative process, as life more of as a collaborative process of all of us working together, it makes it seem less like we're alone.
Yeah, that's something that I fight against quite often, just being kind of like an introvert myself. And I would love to just sort of work on things by myself and not count on other people, because if I make the mistake, then it's all mine. But you're absolutely right. We have to work with other people. And I think that if I have, and even going back to those expectations that you spoke about, if I had, if I expect something from somebody and, or expect something from myself and it doesn't happen, then that's kind of where some of my suffering comes in a sense, and angst and frustration. I can see that. Well, we're, in the book, you have 100 different stories from people, kind of about how they find joy and meaning in their life. What were some of the common threads that you saw that go running through the stories?
I think a lot of what we've talked about before about how important community is, how important other people are. I mean, that's probably the big one for me. It's just the importance of family, friends, relationships, community. Right? How important that is to everyone's life. That's kind of an idea you see again and again and again, how important those things are. And also just the beauty of creating your own path was kind of a prominent theme too, where these are people who made decisions and thought about things and wanted to achieve particular goals. And you set out to achieve that goal through the help of other people, through the support of other people. And one of the great things about, you know, the society we live in now, as troubling as many things are, the fact that we are able to build our own communities in ways we never have been able to before. We're not stuck in communities necessarily simply based on geography. We have people from all over the world who can come together. That was one of the cool things about traveling around the world and meeting with atheist, humanist, free-thinking groups around the world, was that there were these like-minded people. You can go, you know, all the way from Wellington, New Zealand to, you know, Oslo, Norway, and there are like-minded people in both places, in all these different places. And you can find these homes all over the world. So we are a rich and diverse community of people who are really there and supporting each other. And I think that alleviates some of the feelings of being alone that a lot of us kind of deal with, especially those people who kind of came out of more oppressive religious environments.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that. When I had my existential crisis, the thing that that finally solidified me being comfortable with my own new belief system or my own new world system, worldview system, was finding a group of like-minded people. Like, all right, I've come to this conclusion. These other folks have come to this conclusion. We can talk about it safely and securely and use a lot of the same language. That was a huge, huge help me being able to come out of the depression that this whole crisis sent me into. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that.
Also, I should point out that, Eric, you and I know each other because of one of the screenings that I did when you were in Springfield. Yeah. I came out and did a screening there with your organization, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, the Springfield Skeptics, they brought you out, and I think you went on to Mississippi after that?
Yes.
Yeah. And oh man, we had so many people show up, and we had such great feedback afterwards. So I kind of have firsthand knowledge about what these screenings can be like, and what you bring to the screenings as well. And so many people walked out of there feeling uplifted, not only from the books but from the documentary that we were able to screen in the library. This is one of my greatest memories with the Springfield Skeptics group that is out there in Springfield.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
So there is this angry atheist idea. Like, I will honestly say that I am still very angry at religion, even though I may not come across it that way, but I probably fall within that stereotype. What does your book do to kind of dispel that myth? I think we talked quite a bit about it, but is there anything else that we've sort of missed along that same vein?
I think part of it is understanding that what I'm trying to do is I'm not trying to invalidate that anger, right? Like, I think that anger is important, and I think that it goes back to what I was saying before. I'm privileged not to have that specific anger because I wasn't brought up in that environment. But I completely understand why people are angry, and it's completely justifiable that people are angry. I was just of the opinion that it shouldn't be the only way we talk about these things. So I think the anger is important, and it's valid. But yeah, I think it's important to also talk about these other things, because I think if you just have the anger, that makes people a little more frightened about what comes after that. Like, if it's just a bunch of angry people, like, oh, I don't want to be a part of a bunch of angry people. Like, that's going to make me angry.
Yes.
Right. So, yeah, I think it's important to kind of showcase the parts that aren't angry, but understand the anger is valid too.
I absolutely love how you put that, and you're absolutely right. The book doesn't invalidate our anger at all. We can be angry, but under all of that, we can still have a beautiful and fantastic life, full of meaning and joy. Reading through the book, I don't relate to everyone in there, but there are so many people that I can relate to their stories and see myself in their shoes, in a sense. And just talking with you and your whole demeanor and the way you go about life, your character comes out in the book. It's peaceful and relaxing and just kind of just joyful. I'm really, really thankful that you wrote this. This is something that so many of the books that I had read before, like Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great, or even Dawkins' books, or they seem full of vitriol and anger. And this is completely opposite, but doesn't at all invalidate my anger, like you said.
That's good. I like that. Thank you for saying that. And it's interesting because it reminds me, I'm kind of reminded of the book by just looking at the screen right now, because I'm seeing all these boxes of all these people. And I'm just like, how many stories are in these boxes? I mean, I know some of these people, right? Like, yeah. And I know the stories behind the faces I'm seeing. And there's just such a rich tapestry of stories here, and the diversity of people here I'm seeing. I mean, this is what I love about this community.
What do you think it is about stories that really draw us into them? It's something that is so magnetic for me that I'm just want to hear where other people came from and kind of who they are. What do you think it is that makes it that so attractive?
Should put on my Joseph Campbell hat. I don't know. I mean, I think probably something having to do with it kind of, we can relate to other people's stories. It kind of validates our own experience as humans.
Yeah.
We can see ourselves in other people's lives and other people's stories. And there's a lot of power in that. That's why I love movies, right? Like, so I love like telling people stories through film or watching films or, you know, I think there's a lot of power in kind of understanding where other people are coming from through hearing their stories.
Yeah. It definitely brings the topic back to like reality, I think, because if you see, I don't know, numbers of how many people have left religion or how many people, blah, 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 it's not the same as to listening to a specific person telling about their story and kind of humanizing that experience, because it's really an individual behind it and you can also relate to, as you said, their own experiences in maybe other aspects of your life. So when you were saying about, you know, the angry atheist thing, obviously I've been lucky enough that I haven't gone through that process, but I have in other areas of my life that are not atheism. And I just want to add really quickly that I think that when you're speaking to other people and you're trying to relate to their stories, I think it's important to to manage your anger in a way in which it's not expressed in a negative way towards the other person, because I feel like if you do so, you are less likely to get a positive feedback from them. And even to just get out of that conversation with a good mental health yourself, if that makes sense. I'm not sure you have experienced anything like that during the books, or what are your thoughts about that?
What do you mean specifically? So
if we're approaching people who maybe don't believe the same thing as you, what sort of emotional state to be in? As in, like, because obviously sometimes anger can fuel your motivation, so it can be a good thing. But also if you're too angry, then you can push them away. So I'm wondering if while speaking to all of these different people, you have sort of figured out what is the point in which, you know, because you are saying validate anger, yes, being too angry, no. So where is like the middle point, if that makes sense? I'm not sure if I'm making any sense. Probably not.
No, I see what you're saying. I think I tried to kind of just be kind of a blank canvas in a way, like, one thing that I've realized about myself in speaking with many people is that I come across, which I guess is good, as not very threatening, right? Nobody's like threatened by my presence. Nobody's upset by when I enter the room, right?
Except that you pulled a knife on me. That's
true.
Was really scary. When you pulled that knife, you took my wallet actually, that time.
Actually, I'm reminded of an experience I had with you, Eric. Do you remember in the lobby of the library where we were doing the screening in Springfield, this guy walks up to the film start. So I come out into the lobby. This guy walks up to me and he's wearing a t-shirt with a giant American flag and an eagle on it. And just seeing him walking towards me, I think, okay, I don't know if this is going to go very well. Right. And he starts going on about like, who are you? What are you doing here? What's this event about atheist people? And he just went on this rant and I just was like, I don't know. And he registered a complaint with the people at the library that we were exercising our First Amendment rights. He was upset about that. We were doing that. And then he ended his conversation to me by saying, welcome to the Ozarks.
Yep. Yeah, he did.
But, you know, I handled it in a way where it's like, I'm not going to, you know, I wasn't like getting in his face or anything, but I wasn't, because that's just not my style. But it just kind of ended peacefully, I guess. I felt sad for him, honestly.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, he could have seen a softer side of atheism had he just walked into the room and been open to similar to that pastor in Phoenix that you were talking about.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it for me is, in speaking to all these people for the book and for the movie and stuff, is realizing like something I think we should all think of, which is like your personal experience is not necessarily everything.
Right.
Right. Like so many people have so many different experiences. Like that conversation I mentioned about the catcalling, like I would have had no idea had conversations where people brought that to my attention about what their experiences were like. And so that's why just talking to people is so valuable.
So you had mentioned that you've got a podcast. Tell us a little bit about the podcast. What's it all about?
Yeah, so I started a podcast of the same name, A Better Life, as a way to kind of reconnect with people from the book. So I kind of go through and I speak to people who were in the book or the film, but I also speak to people I've met since doing the book and the film that that have interesting stories to tell. And again, it ranges from people who are well-known and people who aren't well-known. So it's because there's so many people I would have loved to include in the book or the film, but I didn't know them at the time or didn't have room or whatever, that it's nice to have this other outlet to do interviews and do long form interviews. It's about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour with each person. So it's nice to be able to kind of have those conversations again in more in depth than maybe just the book or the film as well. So I like doing that.
So it sounds like the podcast is sort of supplemental to the book. It's an extension in a sense, but without the photographs.
Right. So it's like, if you do the book and the film and the podcast all together, it's kind of multi-sensory, in-depth look at different people. So,
awesome. Before we head on to the Q&A part, Chris, would you mind just sort of listing off those tips again one last time about some of the how folks can see the positive in their non-belief?
Oh, the tips I got from John?
Yeah.
So these are not mine. These are from John Hall, who talked about them in my podcast. And he's fantastic. So he said the first thing we talked about was going back to basics. So getting enough sleep, exercise, balance of work and personal life. People get very obsessed with job success. Your job and your personal life can kind of get out of whack in terms of the balance there. So kind of think about those things you mentioned. Accept that change is going to be a part of life and expectations are not always going to be fulfilled. Most of our suffering comes from our own expectations. Learning which things are in your control and which things are out of your control. And the fifth one, which I don't think I mentioned last time, but I'm going to mention it now because it's really important, is most people get joy from helping others.
Oh, yeah.
So volunteer, donate stuff, do street cleanups, that kind of thing. If they found this in studies, that people get more joy from helping other people than helping themselves. So that's a really good way to not only get joy for yourself, right, but also help your community. And we talked about the importance of community too, and that's a really good way to do that. So those are the five things that came from John. And by the way, John just visited Seattle before COVID hit. John visited Seattle when I was here, and I met up with him, and it was great to see him again. He was doing his cycling thing, and he's a great guy. So check out that podcast, and he's in the book as well. So, John Hall.
We will have a link to the podcast definitely in the resources. All right, Amai, you want to hop on into the Q&A part of this?
Yeah, sure. So the first question is quite general. It's basically, where can we find your film work? Because nobody buys DVDs anymore, so I'm going to assume.
Yes. It's true. Nobody does.
They're kind of like getting pissed, like, hey, I've got a DVD player.
My website is, I'm really bad at selling my stuff. Like, I'm always like, oh, you can buy my book if you want to. Like, you know, I'm not a good showman for that. But my book is available at my website, which is theatheistbook.com, which I love the URL I got, theatheistbook.com. You can also get the film there. When you buy the book, you get the download of the film for free. So it's all kind of a package deal.
So you can you can buy the book, and if we wanted to, we could buy the DVD also at atheistbook.com.
You can buy the DVD if you really want to. Yes.
All right, cool. But you have more films out, don't you? More than just A Better Life.
The only one that's out now is the Gwen Verdon film, Merely Marvelous: The Dancing Genius of Gwen Verdon. It was on the BBC this past year. It's now on Amazon, that film that I co-directed and wrote. That's on Amazon Video, so you can find that one there. That's a lot.
What is it about? Like a brief overview of what it's
about. That film is about Broadway dancer Gwen Verdon, who was overcame childhood rickets and being a teenage mother in the 1940s to become kind of the greatest dancer in Broadway history, and kind of this well-known triple threat in theater and film. She was married to Bob Fosse, a famous choreographer. So there was a recent miniseries on FX last year called Fosse Verdon, which is a fictional series which explored their relationship and life. But this is a documentary kind of about her and her life from people who know her and her son, and all these people. So it was a lot of fun putting that together.
Awesome. Now we've got another question here. Does your book touch on community, or does it more focus on the individuals?
Can I give kind of a weasel out answer, which I think is both? Because I think it's true.
Let me guess. Like, you're going to have to buy the book to find out?
No, not even that. No, I think it highlights individuals, but also shows the importance of community. I think so many people talk about the importance of community and family and friends and support. So I think it's both. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it kind of highlights both of those issues.
Yeah, I would agree. It really does talk about how important community is for the folks who are in this, the 100 atheists in here. Absolutely. Do you have any tips on engaging positively with people that that may not like you? Like, you mentioned that a little bit in our own interaction at the library in Springfield, but
Are you saying that there are people out there who don't like me, Eric?
Really hard for me to believe, because like, you are one hell of a guy, but there may very well be some people out there, especially if you're welcomed to the Ozarks.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. We got a great story out of it. I think a lot of it is just not coming off as threatening. I mean, just listening. I do a lot of that. But I don't really know what to say other than just like, just being kind of open and talking to people and not just kind of yelling at people, I suppose. I mean, that's kind of what I do. But I'm not an expert on kind of de-escalation or anything like that. So that's just kind of how I approach things. But part of that could just be that that's kind of how I am naturally. So maybe I have an upper hand in that way.
Yeah, you don't come off as taking things personally. And it seems with the interaction I've had with you, you come at things with a sense of curiosity and openness. Like, hey, I want to hear your story. I want to talk to you. I'm glad you're here. And it seems very easy to talk with people like that.
I went to a Montessori preschool, so maybe it was that.
Very nice. Yeah. we've got some more questions. Amaya, you want to take the next one?
Yeah, sure. So there's someone who is asking about mortality and how we can face, and I quote, the existential dread of knowing that one day I'm going to die. So I think this is a quite common theme amongst especially atheists, just how can we deal with our own mortality, knowing that this is the only life we have and there's nothing we can do about it?
That's a good question. And that's something that is talked about in the book and the film. I think that's a really important thing to talk about, because I think that if you think this is the only life you're going to have, like that there's no afterlife, it really does change kind of how you see things. It really does change the priorities that you want to set, right? The things that are important. And so seeing your own mortality, yes, it can be scary. It can be frightening to think like there will be a time when I'm dead. I mean, I don't want to think about that. I don't like thinking that I could, especially, I mean, given the situation we're in now, like COVID, right? Like, I know people who've gotten COVID. Fortunately, I don't know anyone, I don't think, who's passed away from COVID yet, but given the stats, I probably will at some point, unfortunately. It is hard, but at the same time, I think again, it's that freedom and responsibility thing, right? So I think it frees you up to live the life you want to live now, because you don't know where things are going to go. And that's not to say that, I think that can be oversimplified in kind of this live every day as your last day. Like, clearly, I don't live every day as if it's going to be my last day. That would just be kind of absurd. But just thinking of having a healthy dose of how much time do I have left, kind of in the broad scheme of things. What do I want to accomplish in these number of years that I have? That kind of thing. How do I want to spend my time? What are my priorities? Those kind of things. Taking risks, taking chances, doing things that are scary but could be rewarding if they work out. I think that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah. And then we have one final question. If the folks here buy this book, will you sign it for them?
Yes, I will. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Especially because I'm at the place where the books live. I'm in Seattle where the books live, so it's an easy one to do.
Much easier.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, I can't thank you enough for sitting here with us and talking with us and coming at this so calmly and peacefully. It's just, you seem to exude exactly what you preach, and I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Eric. And thank you to everybody in this room. I love just seeing all these faces here. Thank you to everyone.
Chris, we've got a hangout that happens after we kind of go through this last part. You got a little time to stick around and...
Absolutely.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
Amaya, you want to tell us what's coming up?
Yeah, sure. So next week we're going to have Janice Selby, who obviously she has been here before. She's amazing. She told us about her story with religion and coming out. And it was just so personal and heartbreaking, but also super hopeful. The perfect mixture, really. It was just amazing. So we had to call her back, and thankfully she said yes. So next week she's going to talk about how to think critically, and how because in religious communities people are often disencouraged to think critically, they can lose that kind of skill during their life. So how to kind of recover that and not be vulnerable to other sorts of organizations or influences that may be bad for you. So I'm thinking, for example, I'm not sure if I'm going to say this right, but multi-labeled like organizations, like things like essential oils and stuff like that. People who sell you like miracles and stuff like that.
Oh, MLMs, multi-level organization or multi-level marketing.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's going to talk about that. Someone is asking who is again the speaker. So it's Janice Selby. She's been here before. If you want to look her up, she's just amazing. So that's what we have next week. Eric,
do you want to
close the session?
Yeah. So all previous RFRX recordings can be found on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/recoveringfromreligion. I got to tell you guys, we are so close to 1,000. I looked earlier today and we were like 916 or so. If we get over that 1,000 subscriber mark, then there's a few more things that are unlocked for us that we're able to do, and it'll really help us out. So if you haven't subscribed yet to the channel, I would encourage you to do that so we can get to that 1,000 mark. I'm excited to see those 30s. If you have any questions or topic suggestions or inquiries, please send us an email at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Not only do we have the YouTube channel with all of our RFRX video recordings, as well as a lot of other stories that from RFR volunteers, we also have our blog that's got a ton of fantastic stories and resources, and our podcast. You can find those both at our website, recoveringfromreligion.org website.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.